Thank you all for coming. I'm Penny Rosenwasser with the Middle East Children's Alliance. And without you, we couldn't have an event, so thanks for being here. If you're not familiar with the work of the Middle East Children's Alliance, in the last 23 years, we've raised $17 million in humanitarian aid for children in Palestine and Lebanon and Iraq. And special thanks to Barbara Lubin, our director, without whom that wouldn't have happened. And we have an exciting project that's been going on for a couple of years now. And thanks to a lot of you in this room who've helped with that. And because of that, we have now installed 40 water sanitation and purification plants in 40 schools in Gaza. Absolutely. And what that means is 35,000 children and their families are now all getting clean water. So that's really phenomenal. For those of you who don't know, because of the Israeli occupation, over 90% of the water in Gaza is unfit to drink. So it's huge that these 35,000 children and their families are getting this water. You'll hear more about that later. And in Arabic, the word for water is Maya, so we call this the Maya Project. And tonight is a benefit for the Maya Project. And we are totally thrilled that Adam and Phil have flown here from the East Coast to be with us tonight. And we also have our own Bay Area treasure here with us tonight, Professor George Bisharat. And Professor Bisharat is going to speak briefly about the Goldstone Report and Judge Goldstone's recent op-ed about it. And then he's going to introduce Phil and Adam, and later then we'll be part of the Q&A as well. Professor Bisharat is not just a law professor and scholar, he also has a PhD from Harvard in Middle East Studies and Anthropology. And he wasn't just the deputy public defender of San Francisco, he also publishes articles in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. It's such an honor to have him here with us tonight. So please join me in welcoming Professor George Bisharat.
Thank you so much for coming, and welcome, Adam and Phil. It is an urgent priority for all of us that Israel's impunity from international law, from its violations of international law, come to an end. And that is why the book project, launched by these two amazing writers, Adam Horowitz and Phil Weiss, together with Lizzie Ratner, who is not here, is so important. You probably are all aware that Phil and Adam are co-editors of Mondo Weiss of Blogspot, which is one of the most interesting, provocative, and important sites of information and analysis on Middle East politics that you can find. If you've not yet partaken of it, you absolutely should. They have taken the landmark Goldstone Report, and they've edited it to readable proportions, and they've joined it with incisive commentary by a variety of prominent analysts, and are here today to put this important document into wider public circulation. Now, that may seem like an odd jump from ending Israeli impunity to appraising a book tour by a couple of writers. Indeed, it shouldn't fall on the shoulders of people like Adam and Phil to play a role in ending Israeli impunity. But it does, because our public officials have not only failed to stop Israeli violations of international law, they have been actively complicit in those violations. It is our government, perhaps more than any, that has spun the cocoon of impunity and enabled Israeli officials to escape liability for their wrongs. And I'm sad to say that this is true of Susan Rice, President Obama's UN ambassador, just as true of her as it was of John Bolton and Zalmay Khalilzad, who held that position during the Bush administrations. So recent WikiLeaks releases have revealed how actively Susan Rice, politicked behind the scenes at the UN to subvert the Goldstone Report as well as other UN investigations of Israel's violations of international law. And I'm sure you are aware that Congress has also actively attempted to undermine the Goldstone Report through a number of resolutions that condemn it and that purport to direct U.S. policy to block its effects. The report established that Israel likely committed war crimes before, during, and after the attack on the Gaza Strip in December and January of 2008-2009. Israel's ruinous siege of Gaza, imposed years before the invasion, collectively punished its residents in violation of international law. During the attack, Israeli troops killed civilians without justification, wantonly destroyed civilian infrastructure and private homes, and used weapons illegally. For example, Israeli troops targeted and destroyed Gaza's last functioning flour mill. Israeli armored bulldozers razed the chicken farm that provided 10% of Gaza's eggs, burying 31,000 chickens in rubble. Israeli gunners bombed a raw sewage lagoon, releasing 200,000 cubic meters of filth into neighboring farmland. Repeated pinpoint strikes on a water well complex destroyed all of its essential machinery. These are just some of the facts that led the mission, the Goldstone mission, to conclude in its report that Israel's objective in the attack was, in quotations, to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population, radically diminish its local economic capacity both to work and to provide for itself, and to force upon it an ever-increasing sense of dependency and vulnerability, unquote. Since a January 2009 ceasefire, Israel has maintained its illegal blockade, keeping relief supplies and construction materials from Gaza and thus guaranteeing continued Palestinian suffering. And yet, in a pattern that is consistent with the past, whether we think of Israel's serial invasions of and 18-year occupation of Lebanon, whether we reference the detention without trial, torture, and assassinations of Palestinians in the occupied territories, or whether we reference the colonization of the West Bank, no Israeli political or military leader truly has suffered any legal consequences for these acts. That's what impunity is. Freedom from consequences for violations of law, whether domestic or international. Israel's impunity, ultimately, is good for no one. Those who suffer worst, of course, are its victims, both past and prospective. Israeli Jews themselves cannot possibly benefit from deepening regional and global enmity against them. We, those of us in the United States here, Israel's enablers in countless ways, also reap a terrible harvest for our unconditional support for Israel. Finally, the global community in its entirety suffers if some of Israel's illegal practices, such as targeted killings, are followed by other nations, such as ours, in effect threatening to rewrite international law through violence and in a way that distorts and undermines the purpose of international law, international humanitarian law in particular, which is to protect civilians and to minimize damage and harm to people even in times of war. Impunity for one state undermines the very legitimacy of international law. It does so because law has no credibility if there are people who live above the law and can engage in actions that others cannot without consequence. International law, we should be aware protects the weak and strong alike, and we ignore its continuing abuse at our peril. Now, in the face of all of the power that is aligned in Israel's support, especially in this country, it may seem like tilting at windmills for people like Adam and Phil to travel around the country promoting this book and to work on their blog and the like. What is the point? Can these efforts to raise American consciousness about the realities of Israel's destructive behavior make a difference? The answer is absolutely. Ideas and perceptions matter a lot. For decades, ever since the 1942 Biltmore program, the Zionist movement, and then subsequently the State of Israel, have recognized this and have identified the strategic centrality of the United States, and in particular, the American public. Vast efforts and sums have been expended to ensure that the American public is exposed only to a, I should say, not just an Israeli narrative, but to a particular Israeli narrative. Needless to say, the Goldstone Report does not fit that narrative easily, and that is why it has been the subject of such withering attack by Israel and its supporters in this country and elsewhere. Nonetheless, things are changing. It is, after all, a tough challenge to convince the world that the sky is red and to persuade people not to believe what their eyes plainly see. So perhaps we are, as a public at least, in this country, starting to come to our senses. Beyond increased public awareness lies the challenge of our seemingly hopeless political class. We have all watched the Arab Spring in amazement and admiration as Arab citizens from all walks of life have risen up to challenge sclerotic, anti-democratic regimes. Perhaps it is not such a preposterous notion to suggest that what we need here is an American spring. After all, our political system, once the envy of the world, seems to have fallen into crippling dysfunction. Somehow, in this American spring, I'm seeing Adam Horowitz and Philip Weiss at the head of the pack. Please welcome them warmly to our community. And then buy their book.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Professor Bisharat, for that. Okay. Thank you so much. Thanks, Professor Bisharat, for that incredible welcome. And thank you, Mecca, for this invitation. Your work has been a model and an inspiration for years, and it's an honor to be here. For those who don't know us, I'm Adam, and that's Phil. And we're going to talk tonight about our book, The Goldstone Report. I'll go first, and then Phil. I'll read some parts and talk about some of our experience around it. And then during the question and answer, which we really want to make sure there's time for, we can talk about whatever you like. The website, the book, anything. I usually start by reading a part from the book, and I will just give a brief intro because I know this crowd is really familiar with the situation in Gaza, the Goldstone Report, but something that you may not know is when the fact-finding mission first traveled to Gaza, led by Judge Richard Goldstone, Judge Goldstone actually set up a parallel process to the fact-finding mission. And that process was based on the truth and reconciliation process in South Africa, which he had witnessed. And through that, he set up through open sessions in Gaza and in Geneva, because he wasn't allowed to enter Israel, where he allowed anyone to come and tell their story. anyone who lived through the fighting, anyone who lived through Operation Cast Lead. And his belief was, and this was based on his experience in South Africa, that one of the first steps towards reconciliation and towards justice is simply the ability to tell your story and to have your story be heard. And these stories were not included in the Goldstone Report, the official document released by the UN, but they were published by the UN. And we were lucky enough to get access to them and incorporated some into the book. So I'm going to start off by reading one of them. This is a 30-year-old father of three named Khaled Abdrabo. On the 7th of January at 12:50 p.m., the Israeli army bulldozed our garden and the Israeli tanks were positioned in front of our house. They started yelling at us through the speakers and asked us to leave our house. So I came out along with my wife and my three children, Suad, 8 years old, Samar, 4 years old, and Amal, 3 years old, and my mother, who was 60 years old. We were all holding white flags. The Israeli army was stationed right across from our house, so we stood by the entrance and we were holding flags, white flags. The tanks were 7 meters away from our house, and they did not say anything to us. There were two soldiers sitting on top of the tank. One of them was eating chips. The other one was eating chocolate. We were looking at them like, you know, what are we supposed to do? Where are we supposed to go? We were then surprised because all of a sudden a third soldier came out of the tank and started shooting at the children with no reason, no explanation, no pretext. My daughter, 3 years old, her stomach was hit and her intestines were coming out. I was really amazed. How could a soldier be firing at my daughter? So I carried my daughter, 3 years old. She could hardly breathe. Like I said, her stomach was wounded. My other daughter was also wounded in her chest. So I took both of them, Samar and Amal, inside the house. My wife and my mother and my other daughter, Suad, were still outside. But all of a sudden, my wife joined me carrying Suad. Her chest was wounded by many bullets. My mother, 60 years old, she was carrying a white flag, and she was also wounded on her forearm and also in her stomach. So we were all inside the house, and we started calling the ICRC, the ambulances, anybody to come and rescue us, but nobody came. All of a sudden, we heard an ambulance, but then all of a sudden, nothing, silence. Later, we saw that the Israeli soldiers had asked the ambulance drivers to come out of the car to undress, and they bulldozed the ambulance using their tank. My daughter Amal, 3 years old, she was dying, and by the end of the day, she did die. My other daughter, 8 years old, like I said, her chest was riddled with bullets. She passed away. My other daughter, Samar, she was riddled with bullets. Her back was open. She was not breathing through her nose, but through her lungs, and she was telling me, "Dad, help, help," and I couldn't do anything. She was thirsty. I was afraid if I gave her any water, something would happen. I didn't know what to do. My mother, 60 years old, she was also dying. I was helpless. I didn't know what to do for my children. There was my daughter dying in front of me. So I carried her and left the house, even if I had to die myself, because I couldn't take it anymore. I carried my daughter and left the house again, so that soldier, he might as well just kill my daughter and kill me myself, because I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't let my children die in front of me. Like I said, that's a piece that I usually begin with when I talk about the book, and I do that for several reasons. One of those reasons is just to take us back to what it was like in that moment in the winter of 2008-2009 and help us just recenter on what it, how we can imagine what it must have been like inside of Gaza. Another reason I share that is because, you know, oftentimes people will ask us, why did we put out a book about a UN report? And there's several reasons for that, and we'll talk about it. But really, one of the reasons, and in the Goldstone Report itself, it does an amazing job at raising the voices in this conflict that we never get to hear. As much attention as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict gets in its way, even in the mainstream media, we so rarely get to hear the voices of the people directly affected, directly living under siege, directly living under occupation. And the Goldstone Report is an incredibly powerful tool at doing that. Another reason that we put out the book and why we feel that the Goldstone Report is important, and Professor Bisharat got to this a little bit, is that I think at its heart, and the reason why I think the report has been as controversial as it has been, is because at its heart, it is a call for accountability. And unlike previous reports that have either been put out by the UN or other agencies, it charts a clear path towards that accountability. And it's that path that the US, the Obama administration, and others are trying to stop. Just to recount a bit, and we had some of this in the introduction, the report does find that both Israel and Hamas were guilty of war crimes during the fighting in the winter of 2008-2009, and possible crimes against humanity. I think one of the most sort of grievous charges against Israel is their use of disproportionate and indiscriminate force in Gaza. I know a lot of people will have questions about the op-ed that Judge Goldstone wrote, and we'll talk about it a little some, and we can certainly talk about it more during the Q&A. But one of the charges he made in that op-ed was that he no longer believes that Israel had a policy to target civilians. One of the interesting things to remember is that that's not a charge that's actually made in the report itself. What the report says is because of using this strategy of indiscriminate and disproportional force, Israel made it impossible to protect civilians. And that's a different charge, but that's a war crime. One of the things that the Goldstone Report does that I also think is so important is that it puts that policy in a context. That Israeli policy did not begin with Operation Cast Lead. And in this way, the Goldstone Report, I think, serves as one of the best primers that we have on this most recent phase of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I want to read from a part of the official Goldstone Report where it talks about this policy and where it came from. Israel's operations in the occupied Palestinian territory have had certain consistent features. In particular, the destruction of buildings, including houses, has been a recurrent tactical theme. The specific means Israel has adopted to meet its military objectives in the occupied Palestinian territory and in Lebanon have repeatedly been censured by the UN Security Council, especially its attacks on houses. The military operations from 27 December to 18 January, which is Operation Cast Lead, did not occur in a vacuum, either in terms of proximate causes in relation to the Hamas-Israeli dynamics or in relation to the development of Israeli military thinking about how best to describe the nature of its military objectives. A review of the available information reveals that while many of the tactics remain the same, the reframing of the strategic goals have resulted in a qualitative shift from relatively focused operations to massive and deliberate destruction. In its operations in southern Lebanon in 2006, there emerged from Israeli military thinking a concept known as the Dahiya Doctrine, as a result of the approach taken to the Beirut neighborhood of that name. Major General Gadi Eisenkot, the Israeli northern commander-in-chief, expressed the premise of that doctrine. This is a quote. What happened in the Dahiya quarter of Beirut in 2006 will happen in every village from which Israel is fired on. We will apply disproportionate force on it and cause great damage and destruction there. From our standpoint, these are not civilian villages. They are military bases. This is not a recommendation. This is a plan, and it has been approved. The report then goes on to quote Israeli leader after Israeli leader saying that what Israel did in Dahiya, it was going to do in Gaza during the lead up to Operation Cast Lead. And the report concludes, the mission does not have to consider whether Israeli military officials were directly influenced by these writings. It is able to conclude from a review of the facts on the ground that it witnessed for itself that what is prescribed as the best strategy appears to have been precisely what was put into practice. And I know that Professor Bisharat already sort of outlined this, but I think it bears repeating that what that strategy meant in Gaza was the purposeful destruction of the civilian infrastructure, what it takes for the daily livelihood of Gaza. And that include, and again, I'll read the list of the chicken farms in Gaza, the flour mills, the sewage plants, the water wells, what it takes daily life to continue, in addition to over 1,400 Palestinians killed. And I think, and again, this is a quote that Professor Bisharat read, but I think it bears repeating again, where the report concludes that the attack was a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. And you have to remember that Israel's rationale was that it was entirely security-based defensive attack. The Goldstone report finds otherwise. I think one of the other, you know, in talking about the Goldstone report as a primer or Operation Cast Lead as being reflective of this moment, and again, Professor Bisharat talked about this too, I think it's important to remember the U.S. role in all this. If you remember back to the attack on Lebanon in 2006, it was Condoleezza Rice at the UN who was actively working against a ceasefire while the rest of the international community was trying to put an end to the fighting. At that time, she said that we were witnessing the birth pangs of the new Middle East. Similarly, in Gaza, and Israel tried to exploit the time between the Bush and Obama administrations, and people were calling out to Obama to speak out against the onslaught in Gaza. And although he was speaking out about other international issues, he refused to talk about this. And then Israel was mindful enough to end the fighting just days before his inauguration, so he wasn't put on the spot immediately. And I think the flotilla is another example of this too, where you can say Israel used both indiscriminate and disproportional violence in killing 9 of the activists on board, including a U.S. citizen, and still the United States was silent. So while this most recent period, going back to 2006, seems to be a period marked by horrible massacres, U.S. silence, and I would agree, Israeli impunity, I think this has also been an incredibly inspiring moment as well. Because with each of these attacks, with each of these moments, we've seen the grassroots movement for Israeli accountability growing by leaps and bounds. And I'm just going to finish my portion here by reading a bit from the introduction that we were lucky enough to get from Naomi Klein, where she addresses this point. While Western governments continue to protect Israel from accountability, insisting that economic sanctions are off the table, and even welcoming Israel into the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, civil society around the world is filling the gap. The findings of the Goldstone Report have become a powerful tool in the hands of the growing movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which is attempting to pressure Israel to comply with international law by using the same nonviolent pressure tactics that helped put an end to apartheid in South Africa. Thanks to this crucial book, many more people will be able to read the text of the report and make their own judgment about whether Israel has been unfairly singled out or whether, on the contrary, it is finally being held to account. One of the most remarkable responses to the report came in January 2010, when a coalition of 11 leading Palestinian human rights groups called on Hamas and the Palestinian Authority to investigate Goldstone's allegations that they were complicit in war crimes. This was despite the fact that the Israeli government had refused to launch an independent investigation of the far more numerous allegations leveled against it in the report. Theirs was a deeply courageous position, one that points to what may prove to be the Goldstone Report's most enduring legacy. While most of us profess to believe in universal human rights and oppose all crimes of war, for too long those principles have been applied in ways that are far from universal. Too often we make apologies for the crimes of our side. Too often our empathy is selectively deployed. To cite just one relevant example, the UN Human Rights Council has frequently failed to live up to its duty to investigate all major human rights abuses, regardless of their state origins. So while the Council boldly created the Goldstone Mission to investigate crimes in Gaza, it stayed scandalously silent about the massacres and mass incarcerations of Tamils in Sri Lanka that were alleged to have taken place within months of the Gaza attack. This kind of selectivity is a gift to defiantly lawless governments like Israel's, since it allows states to hide behind their critics' hypocrisy. But now a new standard has been set. The Goldstone Report, with its uncompromising moral consistency, has revived the old-fashioned principles of universal human rights in international law. Enshrined in a system that, flawed as it is, remains our best protection against barbarism. When we rally around Goldstone, insisting that this report be read and acted upon, it is this system that we are defending. When Israel and its supporters respond to Goldstone by waging war on international law itself, characterizing any possible legal challenge to Israeli politicians and military officials as lawfare, they are doing nothing less than recklessly endangering the human rights architecture that was forged in the fires of the Holocaust. One of the people I met in Gaza was Ibrahim Moamer, chairman of the National Society for Democracy and Law. He could barely contain his disbelief that the crimes he had witnessed had not sparked some kind of an international legal response. Israel needs to face war crime trials, he said. He's right, of course. In a just world, the testimonies collected in this book would not merely raise our consciousness, but they would be submitted as evidence. But for now, in the absence of official justice, we have to settle for what the survivors of Argentina's most recent dictatorship have called popular justice. The kind of justice that rises up from the streets, educating friends, neighbors, and family until the momentum of its truth-telling eventually forces the courts to open their doors. But it all starts with reading the report. So I'll leave it at that.
Good evening. And I also want to thank Mecca for having us out here. It's just great to be honored by an organization that has been so inspiring to us and just, you know, a sterling example of moral commitment. So, Barbara, thank you. And also I want to read the other co-sponsors include KPFA, the National Lawyers Guild, U.S. Palestinian Community Network, JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, Global Exchange, Bay Area Women in Black, Code Pink, and the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network. I don't know how many of you know Judge Goldstone's story, but two of the important moments in his story are that before he went into Gaza in June of 2009, he had dreams of being kidnapped by Hamas. He had a dream about being kidnapped. And I also went in at that time, and the only way we think of Gaza in the West is as this terrorist entity. And one understands why he had that dream. And when he came out of his 2 weeks in Gaza, or 10 days in Gaza, he said that he was going to have nightmares for the rest of his life about what he saw. And his dream of being, his nightmare of being kidnapped had been replaced by a feeling of complete solidarity with a people whose dignity had been assaulted. And the basis of international law is preserving human dignity. That's at the heart of international law, is really a spiritual principle that he had seen demolished again and again in Gaza. Now, as I say, I went into Gaza at the same time, and so when I helped to edit this book, I could remember, I saw the things that he was documenting. And I want to just name a few of these things to convey to you what it was like to go into Gaza. And even today, Gaza has still not been rebuilt. So you could go, if you can get in now, you can see the evidence of this onslaught 2.5 years later. I saw the American school destroyed, completely destroyed by bombs. There was a sprinkler going in the grass, but the school itself had been destroyed. The Israelis knew it was a school. I saw the Adam Red from the Abed Rabo family experience in northeast Gaza, near the border to Israel. And the this man, whose two children were killed, two daughters were killed, and the third maimed on that day, and I believe his mother also was attacked. He described an ambulance being bulldozed. I saw that ambulance 6 months later, under the rubble, destroyed. And so Goldstone also saw that ambulance. So when Abed Rabo, when he described that ambulance being bulldozed, there was evidence before the judge's eyes. And I also saw the family home that had been hit by white phosphorus and was blackened throughout, and their child was still unhealed from the scorching flames of this, a weapon that's illegal to use in any sort of civilian setting, had been used in a civilian setting, had destroyed most of this family and left this girl scarred for life with scars that were preventing her from growing. And finally, 6 months later, she was brought to the United States. I believe that these scars have been removed. I think that she is developing. But this was the case 6 months after the fact. And I know that from one of Goldstone's appearances, one of the things that is going to give him nightmares for the rest of his life is the fact that he had seen, he said this at Yale. It's not emphasized in the report. It's in some of the matter that was included with the report, the photographs. There was satellite imagery that they had of the Gaza Strip, and Goldstone saw in fields in the south of the Gaza Strip that Israeli tanks had carved a big Star of David in a field. In destroying a field, they had created this Star of David. And this was a very emotional experience for Goldstone, because he is a Jew, and one cannot remove the fact that he is Jewish from the reception of this report, just as one cannot remove Adam's and my Jewishness from our significance in this solidarity struggle and the journalism that we produce. It's not everything about what we do, and it's not a trivial piece. It's a small but crucial piece. And Goldstone, and I say, when one of the ways I convey my experience of the Gaza Strip was that when I was a kid, in my mother had six children. She'd like to say one for each of the millions who were destroyed in the Holocaust. And she only bought used books in our house and used clothing. I grew up with that, only used things, secondhand. And she, when we were teenagers, bought us new copies, all six of us, of Roman Vishniak's photographs of the Warsaw Ghetto. It was important enough for her to spend, I don't know, $50 each on a book of photographs of the Warsaw Ghetto to engrave upon us the Jewish experience in Eastern Europe. And this was our cultural, religious memory that was being inscribed in us. And spontaneously, when I was in the Gaza Strip, all I could think about were those images. that she had given me, that she refuses to deal with herself when I talk to her about the experience of the people in Gaza. And I want to tell you that one of the most vivid experiences we had when we were in the Strip was meeting the head of a library, a woman named Reem Abu Jaber. And this library, a beautiful library for the children of Gaza City, had been hit by Israeli munitions and artillery during the assault. And she passed around to this group of us who were meeting with her some of the armaments that had fallen on this library. And it was a delegation of probably 25 Americans in this room. And Reem is a very impressive woman. She's highly educated. She could be working in London or the Emirates. Her sisters, I believe, are in London and the Emirates. But she's chosen to stay in Gaza to help her people. And as she spoke to us strangers, she broke down and said, because she can't get out of the Strip. She can't even go to her sister's wedding in the Gulf. And she broke down. This was, again, a few months after the Gaza assault, and said, why have we been abandoned by the world? This is the worst conditions have ever been in Palestine, and the world doesn't care. And that sense of loneliness is something that we saw again and again in Gaza, a sense of being cut off and abandoned by the human family. And that sense is what I believe motivated Goldstone. Now, I said to Reem on that occasion that while things had never been so bad in Palestine, which I accept the Palestinian accounts of, that things were getting better in the West. And I could point in that room to Medea Benjamin, the head of Code Pink, who was there. And I could say to Reem, Medea did not go near this issue until this happened. And to her incredible credit, when this happened, Medea threw herself into... Medea, who had worked on third world issues all her life, but came from a family with some Zionists in it, and you know the usual prohibitions that exist inside the Jewish family had operated on Medea. When this happened, she threw herself into this issue. She's been there many times. She's been a leader on this issue. And similarly, Naomi Klein had largely avoided this issue. She wrote the introduction to our book. And Naomi, when she went to Ramallah a few months after this onslaught, she apologized to the people of Palestine for her cowardice. And also in that room was Norman Finkelstein, the scholar of the Israel-Palestine situation. And I said to Reem, I know that these people are not suffering anything like the degree to which you are suffering. Norman has lost jobs over this. Norman is an isolated figure. And I said something that I've heard a number of times around this solidarity struggle, which is that those who express solidarity with the Palestinian people will get a taste of the Palestinian experience. They're not going to get a full dose of the Palestinian experience, but they will get a taste of it. And I think that if you look at what Judge Goldstone did when he was so moved by what he saw to write this incredible report, really a landmark document of international law and certainly of this conflict, what befell him was also a small portion of the Palestinian experience, because he found himself smeared, isolated, attacked. He was called a traitor inside the Jewish community. The American government came down on him. Here's a guy who is a complete insider You're never going to meet more of a insider than Judge Goldstone. And he was battered. He was excommunicated. And it was a terrible experience for him. Now, Norman Finkelstein and Adam Horowitz and Phil Weiss and Barbara Lubin are people, and many of the people in this room, and George Bisharat as well, and Sitch Nayad, and Jeff Blankfort, we are people who are more used to this type of experience of grassroots engagement. Judge Goldstone was not used to that. And what he found was this just incredible onslaught against his work. And lo and behold, as Adam pointed out a few weeks back, he retracted part of his report in this really shocking op-ed in the Washington Post. And I think that, and that op-ed has acted to undermine some of the force of this report. So one has to ask, you know, why are we still pushing the report? Is the report a success despite this? And I would say absolutely, it has been an incredible success, the report, in raising awareness about this issue. And I would just emphasize, if I were talking to Reem now, this person who felt so lonely, and I'm sure she still feels incredibly lonely in Gaza, I could point to many things that have happened since June 09 that the Goldstone Report has played an important role in, and they include the flotilla coming a year later. They include the flotilla that's being planned now. They include the Gaza Freedom March, in which I participated at the end of 09, and that Medea Benjamin and Code Pink played such an important role in. And they include the international effort now to isolate Israel through the boycott movement. That has been aided by the Goldstone Report. And it includes the international effort to recognize a Palestinian state. You know, 60 years after Arabs were promised a state, 60 years in which we have Pakistan getting a state, India getting a state, Israel getting a state, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kosovo, everyone gets a state. You know, the international community recognizes this as this great failure. And so there's this effort to recognize a Palestinian state. This, too, is part of the Goldstone effect that is taking place. So I just want to emphasize that the report has played this incredible role in, I think, taking the Palestinian experience and making it something that others can share in. And the racism, the hatred, the demonization, the assault on dignity that has been perpetrated against these people for so long, this report has helped to break down. And so more and more people around the world are willfully tasting some of the Palestinian experience.
Wow, thank you very much, both of you, all three of you. Thanks for coming here. We really appreciate it. I'm sort of at a loss for what to say. I'm supposed to ask all of you for money for our water project. Maybe I'll stick to that. I was there at the time of this latest assault on the people in Gaza. I was there. I was in Cairo for 3 weeks buying, I think most of you remember, buying an ambulance, and we shipped in 4 tons of medicine and baby food and all kinds of things, over almost $2 million worth of aid to people in Gaza at that time. And I went in and crossed the border the last day of the assault and was there and witnessed most of what you're talking about. But, you know, I just felt like, you know, when you were speaking, I thought, the last 4 weeks I've sort of been in my house. I've been going through old papers and looking at things. And one of the things that really has struck me in going through all of my old files for the last 23, it was 23 years on May 1st, was the fact that what happened in Gaza was horrific and escalated quite a bit, but that all of the years that I've done this work, these things have been happening in different places in Palestine. I came across a folder and a paper that I wrote about a village in the West Bank. It's called Nahalin. And I was there. This was, I think, in 1990, when the Israelis circled their village in the nighttime. And at 4 a.m, when people went to the mosque to pray, the Israelis opened fire and shot and killed many of the people in the village, and they killed all of the animals. And over again, in going through these papers, I'm finding all of these things that I had forgotten about some of them. But what happened in Gaza was horrific. But this has been going on for Palestinians for over 63, 64 years. It hasn't gotten the publicity that it's getting now, especially for the reason that you spoke about, because finally, people in the peace movement in the United States are involved in it. But it's not that it wasn't happening all those years. So I do want to say that out of what happened in Gaza 2 years ago came our Maya project. Dr. Mona Alfara, our project director in Gaza, went to a school right after this happened, to the Berej Boys School, and asked them what could Mecca do for them. And they said that more than anything, that they wanted to be able to come to school and have a clean glass of water. Over the years, the many years that Israel has occupied Palestine, they have taken the water, they've stolen the water, they have sent it to their swimming pools in the West Bank and their settlements. And so the water is putrid, and people are getting sick and are dying because of it. So as a result of her meeting, we started a project, building water purifications and desalinization systems. As I look out, I see people who have taken this issue on themselves and have built, have given money to raise these, to build these systems. And we're trying, we have 250 more to go. And I hope that you'll think about forming a committee in your community, in your church. Corey's doing it. Others have done it. Hassan has built them. And think about ways that you can help the children in Palestine. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Barbara. So now it's your turn. We're going to do question and answer with Phil and Adam and also with George. And we're going to try something a little different than we've done in the past. Ziad is going to have a mic, and he will go around, and if you have a question, you can raise your hand. And you've also, many of you have also already turned in cards with questions, so we're going to alternate between folks raising their hands in the audience and the questions that Sophia's collecting. So if you do have a, and Lamia's collecting, so if you have a card with a question, please give it to Sophia or Lamia, and they are going to give it to George. And we would just ask you, because, you know, if a lot of folks may want to have questions, if you are on the mic, if you would please keep your comment or question to 1 minute. And it's fine to disagree with what anyone said, but to please have an attitude of respect. And now I'm going to turn it over to George and Ziad.
Well, I have one question that has already been submitted via card, so I think I'll start with that, if that's okay. And the question is, given all this attention Judge Goldstone's this attention to Judge Goldstone's op-ed. Why isn't anyone mentioning the IDF report from last July that actually confirmed most of Goldstone's findings?
I mean, I think that's a great question. I think one other point that I want to just make, because I think it's useful in terms of talking about the Goldstone op-ed, in addition to what Phil said, in addition to the point that I made earlier about the point he supposedly retracted versus what actually appeared in the report, is in his op-ed, he refers to a UN committee report to say in his op-ed that Israel has been investigating itself and that Israel's been holding those accountable who committed the crimes described in the report. And that's all that he ever wanted, was for both Israel and Hamas to investigate themselves. In the report that he's referring to is after the Goldstone report was issued, there have been several follow-up committees that have been put together that are charged with following how both Israel and Hamas are carrying out the recommendations of the report. So every 6 months, they'll issue a report saying, you know, Israel has carried out this investigation, or Hamas has investigated this. And the UN committee put out one of these reports on March 18th, and then Judge Goldstone's op-ed came out on April 1st. And in his op-ed, he said that the UN committee had found that Israel's investigating itself. Again, one of the curious things about that op-ed is if you actually look at that UN report, it says the opposite. It says that instead of that Israel's been investigating itself to international norms, that it has been carrying out investigations, but they are not investigations that this UN committee could support. And they gave two examples. One was, it contrasted two cases. One case was a case where IDF soldiers were found guilty of using a nine-year-old and an 11-year-old boy as human shields, and basically as human minesweepers. They were sent into a field that they expected there were bombs, and they forced these boys to look through bombs that they thought there were bombs in. Israel investigated this, found the IDF soldiers guilty of having done this, and their sentence was that they were reduced one rank within the IDF and given a suspended sentence. At the same time, Israel investigated another IDF soldier who was found guilty of having used a credit card that he had picked up in a house in Gaza. You know, they often will go in and take over a house. Well, this one soldier, as they took over the house, picked up a credit card, went back home after the fighting and used that credit card. That soldier was found guilty and sentenced to 7 months in prison. And so the UN report says, you know, we weren't given access to the full cases here, but any case that finds, you know, gives a suspended sentence to a case of a human shield and 7 months in prison to someone who used a credit card, that these aren't investigations that we can endorse. At the same time, and this is another reason the Goldstone report is so important, is that it not only calls on Israel and Hamas to sort of take a bad apples approach, which is to, you know, and sort of go after the soldiers who carried out these crimes on the ground, but it calls on these on Israel to investigate the people who created the policy, who created the policy of the Dahiya Doctrine, like I talked about earlier. And the UN report says that Israel has shown no sign of doing this, and it talks about why that is. It ends up that the office within the IDF that's carrying out the Israeli investigations, it's called the Military Advocate General, is the same office that would be responsible in defending Israeli military officials from any cases brought against the IDF. So in effect, this is the IDF's own lawyer who is supposed to be investigating Israeli crimes in Cass Led. And the UN, and actually in the Goldstone report itself, has found that that doesn't meet international standards. So I just think that's another important point to remember when responding to criticisms of the Goldstone op-ed. In terms of the question, why was the op-ed picked up but not these other points I'm making or previous reports? And of course, the op-ed was seized by Israel's defenders to use any opportunity they can to further Israeli impunity. But I think one of our challenges is to get out the other side of the story.
There are, okay, let's, yeah, that's right, we're supposed to alternate. So.
Is this on? The recent reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah seems to have become a joyful event for Netanyahu. Do you have any feeling about how that's going to affect the effort in the UN for recognition of Palestine as a state?
You know, Ziad, do you want to answer that question?
I leave it for George.
Okay.
I think it's going to complicate, slow down that process. I think there would have been many more governments that would have been comfortable backing a solely PA Fatah PLO initiative than would be comfortable under these new circumstances in supporting a unity government in this respect. So I'm not sure how it's going to play out ultimately. But I suspect it's going to make things more difficult and complicated. So there were three questions that had to do with the retraction in the op-ed, and so maybe Phil, if you don't mind, I'll ask
sure.
you this: what exactly did Goldstone retract? Would you clarify his retraction? Why do you think he wrote the retraction? Especially if what he retracted wasn't really part of the report, what was his motivation? If you have any idea.
What he retracted in this op-ed in the Washington Post was he said that if I knew now what if I knew then what I knew now, I would not have written the same report about the Gaza conflict. And specifically, he said that the idea that Israel deliberately targeted civilians, he said that was a central charge of the report, and we would not have made that charge. He said, and he used one of the most dramatic incidents of the Gaza conflict in which Israel fired missiles at a house from a helicopter gunship in which 120 people were huddled, and Israeli soldiers had forced them into this house because it was sort of in the path of their approach to Gaza City, this neighborhood. The missiles hit this house and 29 people in the end were killed in this one extended family. And in the actual report, they said that this appeared to be a deliberate targeting of civilian. I don't know if it was not deliberate targeting, but sort of indifferent. It violated the laws of war by showing a lack of distinction between civilian and military targets, and in using disproportionate force in a civilian setting. So when he said that Israel did not deliberately target civilians, the actual report does not say that there was a policy of deliberately targeting civilians. It says that there was a policy of indiscriminate attacks that terrorized a civilian population. And as one of we have one pro-Israel essay in the book, and as Moshe Halbertal, a professor of philosophy in Israel, says, if they had intended deliberately to target civilians, they would have killed far more than 1,500 people. And that's true. But the report doesn't say that they were just deliberately targeting. It was showing incredible indifference that violated the laws of war. So Goldstone retracted a point that the report actually did not make, as Adam pointed out. And why did he do it? I think he did it because he was under incredible pressure, that Netanyahu had described this report as one of the great threats to Israel, along with Hamas rockets and Iranian nuclear plans. It truly was, this report was a huge threat to Israel. It actually threatened to end the culture of impunity. It actually threatened to that there would be Israeli officers in the dock at The Hague answering for crimes. So this has been this incredibly important report that the organized Jewish community that is so supportive of with exceptions like Jewish Voice for Peace and a couple of other organizations, but the organized community of Israel support was raging against this report just for because it was such an important document. And I think that that pressure got to Goldstone. I think he said that he was going to try to nullify some of the worst things his report did in order to make things easier for Israel.
During World War II and years afterwards, I traveled back and forth to the Middle East. And in the last few months, there's been a wave of democratic in spirit in these countries over there that amazes me. And I wonder if nobody's talked about how this is going to affect Israel and the Palestine situation there. I wonder if you could give us some prediction of what's going to might happen.
Well, I think the change is overwhelmingly positive, not only for the peoples of the individual countries themselves, but also for the Palestinians. And we're seeing a very concrete example of that in the changed positions that the Egyptian government has been taking. And, you know, it appears that it will finally be ending its cooperation in the Israeli siege, which it had been quietly doing for a number of years. And so it appears that it will be permanently opening the Rafah crossing into Gaza. You probably saw the polling evidence that something like 54% of the Egyptian public is in favor of repudiating the peace agreement with Israel. I don't think that's going to happen, but the fact that there is that public sentiment creates a very different dynamic. And the fact that, that public sentiment has been there, but the fact that it may now be reflected in government policy is the change. There are moves to renegotiate the natural gas agreement, which Israel has had with Israel, and has been selling natural gas to Israel at very preferential rates. I think all of those are very concrete examples of the positive changes that we can look forward to. I suspect that that the stance that the Arab governments will be taking with respect to this issue in the United Nations and elsewhere will be more supportive, more positive than it has been for some period of time.
Yeah. I want to add just something to that too, which I think deals sort of with how this moment, how the Arab Spring, so to speak, well, also has affected perceptions here in the United States as well. And I know one of the mm-hmm. things that I've been struck by, I was born in 1973, I think I could truthfully say for my entire life, the only, within either the popular culture, the mainstream discourse in this country, the Middle East, the Arab Muslim, citizens, countries of the Middle East, have been discussed only in the most negative terms, in terms of terrorism, in terms of being the enemy, in terms of being this force that we here in the United States need to be afraid of. And I was struck by how quickly that fell apart, or at least seemed to fall apart. It really seemed that it started to bubble up a little bit around Tunisia, but really after the first weekend of Anderson Cooper being in Tahrir Square, You looked at the polling, and the populace of the United States was behind the protesters and was inspired by the protesters, was rooting for the protesters against the government that the United States had kept in power for these last decades. I think that was an incredible moment for us to appreciate and understand that this is a moment that we're able to use and exploit. It was also a moment, and I do think that this consciousness is growing too, that it became clear that Israel, which again, for as long as I feel like I've been alive, and certainly the way that I was brought up, you know, we've all heard this statement that Israel's the only democracy in the Middle East. All of a sudden, it was the entire Middle East that was calling for, fighting for democracy, and Israel was the only country, along with these dictators that no one liked anymore, who was fighting to quash democracy. I mean, how is that for, you know, flipping this equation on its head, and I'm sure raising questions in, you know, the eyes of the people in the United States. And I guess also lastly, it also really raised this geopolitical reality that the only way that Israel is able to stay in the position of power that it is, and I would say that Zionism as a system is able to stay in power as it is through the direct support of these dictators that are clearly have been shown to have no support amongst their own people and are really only kept in place through the support of the United States, and that's no longer enough. So I do think, I mean, what Professor Bisharat has said is really the sort of the nuts and bolts on the ground of what we already see changing and what might change more. But I think it is an incredible moment of a changing perception about the region here in the United States that I think could be hugely beneficial for our work.
I have three questions here that are slight variations on a theme. One of them, and they all have to do with the U.S. government and Zionist influence on the U.S. government. So the first one is, how can we make the Goldstone Report affect U.S. foreign policy when Congress refuses to even read it before condemning its conclusions? Another one is, in dealing with information getting out, would it not help to understand how Israel has succeeded in making the U.S. government a colony of their country? And then finally, can you talk about the role of AIPAC and the importance of countering the lobby, moving over AIPAC?
It's funny, I mean, to hear these questions because I certainly am someone who is very committed to the working against the Israel lobby. And it's been now 5 years since Walt and Mearsheimer published their famous paper on the Israel lobby that was such a stunning attack on the Israel lobby. And in the London Review of Books, they couldn't even publish it in this country. And if you read some of what they said in that paper, it's very tame now. And I feel that it's, especially when you hear those questions, and it's kind of like the sort of consciousness raising that I really think is so vital to changing the discourse and ultimately the politicians, I mean, way down the road, that consciousness raising is happening. And people are waking up. And one of the ways that they are waking up is because of things like the UN Security Council vote in February, where the United States was the only... I was in Cairo when Obama said the settlements must end. And then 2 years later, there's a UN Security Council resolution... End the settlement project, free, or, you know, it must end, it must stop. And he vetoes it. So, you know, and I remember interviewing Egyptians that day who took him at his word and who believed him and were very heartened by that commitment on our president's part. And here he went against it. And that was kind of a naked demonstration, I think, of the power of the Israel lobby and his concerns with respect to raising money in the 2012 campaign. And God knows, if you go into the Arab world, you know, I mean, certainly in where, my experiences in Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and Palestine, people there have a pretty sophisticated understanding of what's driving our politics here, and it's a special interest. I think it's a special interest. I mean, there are other factors, but this is a major factor. And as to the question about how to take on the Israel lobby, I think that it's a real, there's consciousness raising. There's this move over APAC event that is going to be happening May 19th through 20 or 21st through 22nd, I think, in Washington, right around the time that Netanyahu is going to be in Washington and APAC is having its. So I feel there's a real grassroots opposition growing. And also, again, on the Jewish piece of this, you know, the strength of the Israel lobby was that it could say, we represent American Jews. American Jews are for, you know, these supporting Israel through thick and thin. So it's been a really important part of this process for Jewish Voice for Peace. Other Jews in sort of prominent Palestinian solidarity activities to say, no, these people do not represent us. They represent this right-wing racist faction in Israeli life. And so I think there's been a real, I'm just encouraged about what's happening with the Israel. I mean, it's a very powerful force still in our political life. Just to throw in one other thing, you know, Tony Kushner, this, you know, a leading playwright in America, was City University of New York was going to give him an honorary degree at commencement, and they withdrew it because of his criticisms of Israel. And there again, why is the City University of New York doing that? It's pretty obviously about fundraising and pleasing a right-wing Jewish community, in pro-Zionist community, that has kind of created an orthodoxy inside Jewish life. And it's that orthodoxy that Jews are so important in taking on. And it's the larger awareness of the Israel lobby that all of us are engaged now in taking on and saying it doesn't represent us.
My questions were also on a card, so let me discard it. But two questions. One, the only crimes I've been aware of by Hamas and in terms of the war were hearing about the firing of the rockets in Israel Shderot. And I wanted to know more about other crimes that you are aware of. And secondly, you had mentioned the idea of a war crimes trial or what that would be. And I'm aware that historically that Bertrand Russell decided on his own that around Vietnam and what the U.S. government did there to start a war crimes trial to really build that. And I'm wondering whether the kinds of work you're talking about and doing can lead to something like that.
Yeah, no, I'll answer that. And I actually have something I want to add to the last question as well. But in terms of the crimes that the report found that Hamas committed during the war, it really was just the point that you made, the use of their rockets. And if you haven't seen these, they're pretty much homemade rockets that are shot from Gaza and go into southern Israel, many times land in the middle of nowhere, sometimes land in populated areas. That they're rudimentary to the degree that they really can't be aimed other than in a general direction. And the report found that the use of this indiscriminate force put a civilian population in harm's way, and the report found that that is then should be considered a war crime. And it's an interesting point, and it's actually one of the other points that doesn't get as much attention that Judge Goldstone made in his op-ed, but it's what ends his op-ed. And it's been something that's been, I mean, there's been a lot of the report that's been challenged, I'd say broadly from the right or from Israel supporters, but there's other parts of the report that have been challenged, I'd say, by the left or people in sort of a Palestinian solidarity perspective. And one of those findings of the report is that the belief that Hamas should be treated as a state actor, more or less, that the laws of war are to regulate fighting between states. And oftentimes, and people will say, but, you know, Hamas is not the head of a state. It's a party resisting occupation, and resisting occupation is legal under international law. And part of what the Goldstone Report was seeking to do was try to take the laws of war and apply them to this current situation where increasingly we're seeing states and non-state actors in combat. But so that's the crime, and the even the applicability of this realm of law to that activity is considered controversial and sort of an open question in international law. I think just the quick answer to the second part of your question is that process actually has been going on, as far as I know, that there was a group that was organizing Russell Tribunal events, primarily, I believe, throughout Europe, looking at Palestine. And I'm sure there's people here who know more about that, to outline a little bit more the process, the official process of the report, and this gets to the previous question a bit. So in September, what just recently happened, to kind of finish the story that I was telling earlier, in March, when the UN committee presented their report to the Human Rights Council, they basically said, originally, both Israel and Hamas were supposed to have 6 months to investigate themselves. They were given 2 years. And this past March, the Human Rights Council said, okay, enough is enough. We're sending the report to the General Assembly to be debated this upcoming September, as per the process in the report. Now, the next stages of this process are that the General Assembly will then send the report to the Security Council with a recommendation that the Security Council send it to the International Criminal Court. In the case that both Israel and Hamas have not investigated themselves. Now, we all know the politics are such that if it does get to the Security Council, it's almost impossible to think that the United States would then allow it to be sent to the International Criminal Court. So, I mean, putting, you know, Congress aside, because really what Congress decides on this isn't as relevant as what the U.S. mission to the U.N. decides. The U.S. policy, which is directly related to the questions of the Israel lobby, we're really going to make it very difficult for the Goldstone Report to go through the official channels as an accountability mechanism. And I think it's sort of unrealistic of us to politically expect that to happen. And still, I think one of the lessons of the report in our moment is that we don't need it to go to the ICC for this report to be effective. And I think that was really the point that Naomi was making in her introduction, that this report has already become such a powerful tool in the hands of international civil society, who is entirely able to circumvent this political process to create accountability on the ground. And that's being done not only through the BDS movement, which I think is an amazingly effective tool, but also through tools like universal jurisdiction, which haven't been as it is applicable in the United States. It hasn't been used as much because for political reasons, but in the UK, in Spain, where arrest warrants have been issued for Israeli military officials. And I think this is one of the other sort of interesting lessons to me from this moment and what we just saw in Egypt. Because one of the things that you'll hear, or at least that I would hear a lot in the United States as an activist working on this issue, is that we really need to focus on changing the U.S. government. Because the U.S. government's what's holding up the system. And as long as the U.S. government's holding up Israel, nothing's going to change in Israel. And I think personally the work to change U.S. policy is incredibly important. But I think that same rationale could have been said about Egypt and about Mubarak. And we saw that regime fall. And the U.S. supported it up to its final hours. So I think we're in a moment where we have tools that we're able to put direct pressure on the Israeli government and the Israeli regime to begin the process of weakening it while we work on changing U.S. policy here. And those two things have to happen at the same time.
So, Phil, this is a question directed to you. You have said that the Goldstone Report has affected the mindset of Americans and people of the world to address the Israeli injustices. However, Americans celebrate the murder of Osama bin Laden by the Obama administration. What do you think Israel will do about the next flotilla? And do you think the U.S. will support the American passengers who will be on board the U.S. Boat to Gaza during the next flotilla?
Well, it's a great question. I'm such an optimist that I think that the loss of Egypt as an ally and the loss of Turkey as an ally, and the loss of Turkey was specifically around the last flotilla. That was the achievement of that flotilla, is that Turkey said, we are no longer going to stand by. It was a very significant event. So I think these two losses are going to make Israel not attack the next flotilla. But that's my, I'm always hopeful and I'm often really wrong. So I'm not a good prognosticator. I think that I'm a rose-colored glasses or glass half full, and anyone who's been glass half full has, had to eat a lot of crow on the Israel-Palestine situation.
Okay.
Regarding the issue of the attacking of civilians, because it seems to me, I'm Israeli and I grew up believing that there's no such thing as a Palestinian civilian. And that's the rhetoric there, is that even children are future terrorists in Palestine. So I'm really curious what the Israeli government is really saying about attacking civilians, since that's the party line that I have been accustomed to. And then on the converse, all Israelis are essentially seen as military, since it's forced conscription. So I was wondering if you could address those definitions, since the lines seem really blurry to me.
Well, I'm going to answer that if that's all right, and then please feel free. People are soldiers when they join an organized military force and they wear uniforms and they participate in combat under, an organized command. That's what makes them combatants. Now, everybody else is a civilian. Civilians can surrender their civilian status by joining in combat, but unless they do that, they're civilians and they are protected, and there is an obligation on the part of all armies under international law to distinguish between civilian persons and civilian objects and military persons or soldiers and military objects. International law does permit militaries to attack civilian targets and civilians themselves if there is a military justification for that attack, and if the attack is proportional. That is to say, the military gain, is not outweighed by the costs to civilian persons or objects. So what the Israeli army argues is, and what their battalion of lawyers and political philosophers and others who justify the Israeli government's army's behavior, is they say it's we're fighting asymmetrical warfare. We are an organized army, but they are not. We observe the laws of war, but they do not. They hide in amongst civilians. They store arms in mosques and transport them in ambulances and that sort of thing. And therefore, if in, fighting to achieve our military objectives and to defend our soldiers' lives, we kill civilians, the onus is on the ones that we're fighting, not on us. That's, essentially the justification. And then, of course, there's an elaborate intellectual, academic effort to you know, to justify all this and to sell these ideas to people around the world. And they have achieved a considerable success in doing so, in the West at least, in the last decade or so. In the, you know, under the aegis of the so-called global war on terror, many of these ideas have been accepted by academics and more particularly by government officials in a lot of countries of the world. And this was what I was alluding to when I was talking about the challenges that Israeli behavior or the threat, more accurately, that Israeli behavior represents for the status of international law. Because if these transformations, if the changes that it is trying to push are accepted on a widespread scale, then we're going to see this kind of mayhem in other places as well. We are seeing it, of course, and you know, Israel is not the only perpetrator of war crimes, and I mean, this country, frankly, is probably the other principal war criminal that suffers no consequences and that enjoys impunity as well. But that's essentially the rationale. Okay. I'm gonna pose a quick one from a card here and answer it. Please tell us what organizations we can support that will skirt U.S. government restrictions. I assume this question refers to material support for terrorist organizations or something along those lines. The obvious one is Mecca, right? So please do support Mecca. I'm going to go to another card quickly. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you for the book and for Mondo Weiss, both vital resources. Question one, have you spoken with Goldstone? Has he responded to the book? Question two, Adam's opening reading about the Abd Rabbo family, it sounded like the soldiers targeted the children. Do you think that this is so?
We did approach Judge Goldstone when we started work on this book, and he very politely chose not to be engaged with us on it. And I think that at that point he was already being isolated inside his community. You know, he was being disinvited from his own grandson's bar mitzvah because the Jewish community, organized Jewish community in South Africa, was saying, "You're such a bad man," and Alan Dershowitz was calling him a traitor. And we clearly were going to do a book that was going to support the report. And I think, this is speculation, but I think that Goldstone was at that point trying to get back in the good graces of official life, and we were not going to aid that process. So he politely declined. I think he said a kind word or two about our book. I'm not absolutely certain, but he has certainly not, there's been no public response to it. My wife likes to say, just want to say, that she thinks that the reconsideration that he issued in the Washington Post was caused by our book. So I just want to, you know, I don't know. But she says, yeah, why did he do it? Adam, do you want to answer the second question?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the answer to the second question regarding the testimony, I started by reading my own opinion as to, you know, did that soldier target those children? I think from what I read, which is all the information that I have, I think the answer would be that they clearly targeted those children. I think one of the important points, though, is that that is a case, but, I mean, the reason for doing so is an open question, and that is a specific case that the Israeli military has chosen not to investigate so far. And that is actually one of the cases that the UN follow-up committee has been following and reporting every 6 months as to whether Israel has looked at it, and they haven't.
And I just want to add, that father, in his testimony, he said, my daughters were this tall, and this tall. And each one was shot in the chest. So the question, I think it's, there's no question that these girls were targeted. And he said, you know, it just wasn't an indiscriminate firing. Each one of these girls was shot in the chest. So whether it's bad apples or whatever, they certainly have not investigated this, you know, credit cards, sure, but.
Yeah, just a brief comment as well on that point. There are bad apples in, you know, in every fighting force, and then there are conditions which encourage bad apples to, you know, to do their bad things. Among the conditions that I think encourage this kind of thing. And by the way, I've been going to the occupied territories since the late 70s, and I could tell you countless stories of situations in which Israeli soldiers, with no apparent justification, opened fire on. I could give you names of victims of people who have been killed in just this way, countless times. And you know, the explanation is, oh, this soldier was crazy or had mental, you know, problems or whatever. But you know, it is. Circumstances of occupation of a people encourage these kinds of things, and then specifically in the lead up to Cast Lead, you know, Israeli military rabbis distributed pamphlets and went and spoke to Israeli soldiers and essentially encouraged them to show no mercy to the Gaza civilian population. And of course, their operational orders, their rules of engagement, were essentially, you know, do everything, you take absolutely no risks to yourselves, and if anybody does anything in the slightest bit threatening, then you're entitled to open fire. And of course, one of the things that Israel did, one of its, you know, proposed sort of amendments to international humanitarian law, is this notion of voluntary human shields. You probably heard that Israel dropped something like 1.5 million pamphlets over the Gaza Strip telling people to leave, and then sent 165,000 text messages to people also telling them to leave, and used a technique called knocking on the roofs, whereby they would their artillery gunners would strike a structurally strong part of a building first, not to collapse it, as you know, as a warning for the people to leave, and then fire into the middle of the building and collapse it. So through all of these various techniques of warning people, Israel was essentially attempting to absolve itself of its responsibility to distinguish between civilians and soldiers, and anybody who didn't respond in that area was called a voluntary human shield, thus a combatant, thus subject to lawful attack. So entire areas that had been subjected to these warnings were free fire zones, essentially. So I can't speak to the specifics of this particular case, but those were the operational rules of engagement. That was the atmosphere, and in that kind of circumstance, you can only expect that these kinds of events will occur.
Yes, hi. I wanted to go back to the rockets issue and also the right of the Palestinian people to self-defense, the people who are in the occupied territories. And I want to qualify this. I do not support rockets. But so at the end of March, during the Litigating Palestine conference that Professor Bisharat organized, Dan Machover, he's an attorney in the UK, and he specializes in international human rights law. He said that Palestinians firing rockets is not a war crime because they are exercising their resistance to occupation and struggling for self-determination. But he didn't rule out possible crimes against humanity. I also had an opportunity to ask Judge Goldstone a question about this was via a radio program forum, Michael Krasny. It was on March 9th, and so there's a transcript of this. So it seems it depends on what time Judge Goldstone is saying what he changes from. Basically, I asked, does Judge Goldstone believe in believe the people of Gaza have a right of self-defense against such attacks by Israel? That I referred to the continual bombing. And if so, what does he think this self-defense should look like? And he said, Israel clearly has the right. So he starts out with Israel, of course. Clearly has the right, and I would add the duty, this is quote, and I would add the duty to defend its own citizens. And I would make it clear that in the Gaza report, we had accepted as a given Israel's right to self-defense. The issue of war crimes is whether that right of self-defense is used legally or was used unlawfully. That is the issue. When it comes to the right of Gaza to exercise self-defense, that would depend on whether there was excessive retaliation, and of course the difficulty for people in Gaza is they really don't have the ability to defend themselves. Apart from these inaccurate, rather rudimentary rockets and mortars, they really have no other way of defending themselves. And perhaps it's that reason that they have to rely so heavily on international organizations to come to their aid. So I don't know if you wanted to comment on that.
I don't know if Professor Bicharat has anything to say. I mean, a few things that I'll add to that. And I mean, I think that was a really useful comment to make. Thank you. A few things to add would be that, I mean, like I said before, the report has been criticized from sort of all directions. And that Judge Goldstone himself, I think, I mean, one of the things that makes it amazing that this report was as controversial as it was that at its heart, it really took some really profoundly conservative views, legal views, like the ones that you were just describing. And even with those concessions, it was considered too much. I mean, the only thing that I would really share in addition to that is, I know on Mondo Weiss, so we've recently posted some of the critiques that have come out, especially since the op-ed, but I'm thinking of ones written by Richard Falk and ones by John Dugard, which took, not only criticized the op-ed, but criticized some of these legal positions that were the basis of the report, that I think are really interesting legal debates. I mean, I think the status of international law is pretty clear, and I would, you know, I totally support what you said. And I think one of Judge Goldstone's sort of missions with this is, you know, the law was set under one set of conditions and contexts, and as those conditions and contexts change, raising the question of whether the law should change too. I really think that Richard Falk's pieces, and I mean, we posted one, they've also appeared on Al Jazeera on his own blog, have raised some of the other really interesting criticisms of the report. And one of them that I was reminded of in listening to what you just said was that, and I'm not the historian that I'm sure many people here are, but he said one of the things that were unique about Castled, which the Goldstone Report doesn't address at all, was that he says it was the first and maybe only time in recent history where the people of Gaza were a population that were refused the right to flee. That they were in a situation where they were being attacked mercilessly, and because of the ongoing siege at the same time, which the report does comment on, but doesn't comment on this condition that the people of Gaza had nowhere to go. One of the points Falk makes is that this was a unique dimension of this attack that the Goldstone Report should have taken the opportunity to comment on, as this is one of the places that it could really help have set a precedent. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of places where, you know, clearly we are strong supporters of the report. I don't agree with everything that's in it. I certainly don't agree with everything that Judge Goldstone says, but I do think that the report itself provides us with some really helpful raw materials to apply and use in our work. And part of that work is going to be engaging in these debates and, you know, supporting the people, people's right to resist occupation.
So I'm going to read one that's more, it's more of a rhetorical question. Did you read Izzeddin Abu'l-Aysh's book about the loss of his three daughters and niece through Israeli fire? I Shall Not Hate is the title. Very important. What issues or campaigns can help reach mainstream public opinion here in the U.S. and engage new, younger, and more diverse groups?
Sure. I mean, I could just sort of comment on my own sort of, you know, personal thoughts about that. I mean, I've already sort of shared my own opinion that, I mean, I think in several ways the real diverse kind of campaigns that we've seen around the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, I think are some of the most effective tools that we have right now. I think not only in terms of actually creating direct pressure on Israeli policymakers, but I think that it has been one of the most effective in public ways in all the different ways that it's taken place of moving the debate into the public here in the U.S. I don't know if that really directly responds to the part of the question about, you know, engaging more diverse audiences, and I think that that really ends up being in many times a question of targets and tactics. But I think that this is really the tool that we have right now that is the best use of our resource and power as a movement, and really has the best chance of helping this movement to grow.
Okay. Yes, I'd like to say that I've been born and raised in the U.S. I vote and have been voting for years, and I think that the name Palestine belonged to an older nation and country, and with Israel's invasion, with the occupation and existence of Israel's state as a state, I think that the only way to resolve this conflict is to have an equal balance of power for both Palestine and Israel, and that there can't be one winner in this situation. They have to have it be an equal vote, equal land. And they need to pick people in government and all levels of officiaries that are representing both sides. And I think that's the important thing, is that both sides are reflected and that they both can bring forth their opinions, and it needs to be a balanced law for all. I think that's the most important thing.
Thank you.
Okay. So just one more question from a card, and then one more from the audience. This last question is related, I think, to the comment we heard from the gentleman. The two-state solution is impossible because the settlers oppose it, and the one-state solution is impossible because a huge majority of Israelis oppose it. What is the positive future vision?
You know, actually, we've had this posted on our site. Recently, a couple of people have made this point that, you know, two-state solution's impossible, and I don't see a one-state solution happening either. And I think that just raises more than any, that just increases the importance of human rights, that within this situation, you know, without a political solution, we've got to keep pushing on the human rights question. And these people have rights that are being destroyed. And, you know, when this gentleman speaks about an equal, powerful power situation, right now there's just no equality in power between the two sides. So regardless of the political situation, which is so blocked in so many ways, we've just got to keep pushing on Universal Declaration of Human Rights. These are the, you know, the codes that animate the Arab Spring have to be applied in this situation too, and that I think is at the heart of the civil society movement.
Go ahead, Sid.
The last question and the last answer just shifted my question. I'm a member of the National Steering Committee of Independent Jewish Voices in Canada. And we have adopted a basic position. We don't opt for one state or two states. We adopt the position that is being promoted by the International Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, which is saying that Israel must withdraw from all lands occupied since 1967, that regardless of whether there's one state or two states, there must be equality of the law and protection of the law and enjoyment of human rights by all citizens of equal citizenry, and three, a recognition of the Palestinian right of return. And then you don't have to get into a debate about the minutiae, about who's going to debate what or whatever. That's what you stand for. It's a very straightforward and a very powerful position.
Joey? Anybody care to respond?
I mean, all that I'll add to that, and if I was to have answered after Phil, I mean, that's exactly the answer that I would give. I mean, I think especially for those of us in the U.S. and North America, that really what we have to be concerned with is less with what the solution will look like, you know, at the state level, as much as what are the conditions that any solution has to meet. And honestly, those conditions that you just said, which are taken from the BDS call, I can imagine in theory how those could be met under any number of different solutions, either one state or two state, but that we all know that the conflict won't be resolved until those conditions are met. And so that really needs to be what's our driving force. And I just think something that's important for us to remember, and it was made by the point by the gentleman here in the front row, is that all we're asking for is equality. And what we're dealing with is a situation of profound inequality. That we're not asking Israelis to give up any of their human rights. But what we are asking them to give up is a situation where they have special and exclusive rights based solely on their religion. And that's true throughout historic Palestine. Anyone who understands that that's the situation on the ground, especially, and I'm thinking about the U.S. context, will understand that by definition, that is a recipe for conflict. And we've seen it in our own country, we've seen it in other countries around the world, that when there's one party ruling over another based solely on its ethnicity or its religion, that will lead to conflict. And so all we're asking are for Israelis to give up that privilege. And in exchange for giving up that privilege, what they're going to find they have is peace and an end to the conflict and their own human rights and their own humanity and dignity intact. So I think that's a challenge for the way forward.
So I hope now any of you who haven't already bought the book will buy it, and Adam and Phil will sign it. I want to thank Alejandro for his help with the sound, and Jenny and Sherry for their beautiful work as sign language interpreters tonight. And yes, we can thank them. And especially, let's give a huge hand to Phil and Adam and George Bisharat. Thank you very much.